President Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I will be with you for the next hour. We have a regular Friday night scheduled guest. For whatever reason, we're not making contact with him, Mr. Jim Murray. And I know our engineer, Don, may try to get in touch with him one more time, once or twice more, but doesn't look like we're getting through. Of course, with the holiday going on and travel and all of that, there may be some glitch that is difficult to overcome. Nonetheless, we have plenty to talk about, and I welcome your calls. It's been a while since we've heard from anyone out in the listening audience, and I know you enjoy the teaching. This is what you have been communicating to me. That said, assuming that you're being honest and don't want to interrupt the flow of information to keep it going tonight, what we're going to ask you to do is call in. You can call in to Station 1 numbers. Those of you who aren't looking at your screen and are just listening to this, the numbers are area code 877-876-5227. And that's toll-free, also in the USA and Canada, 888-815-9756, and the direct line, 876-3222. I'd like to hear from you this evening. Well, I've been announcing several things. We've got Mr. Michael St. Clair coming on the show on January 6th for a two-hour interview. He's one difficult person to get to commit to doing a show. In fact, he refrained for several months from doing shows until an interview he did on a Seattle station a little over a week ago. And it was on AM radio in the Seattle area, and that's going to be broadcast again on January 2nd, just to get his particular message out. Word is he may appear on Coast to Coast with George Norrie on January 5th, and George Norrie's well aware that Michael's coming on this show first. We booked him here first for a two-hour interview, as I already mentioned, and part of the issue here is bringing this information out over mainstream radio. What Michael is going to share with your audience is very, very profound, and it's life-changing, and it's paradigm-shifting, and that is one reason why I want to bring him on. He's been on the show three times. We've done three-hour interviews back when he was living in Nova Scotia, and he's in Europe now and doing quite well. He's written three books, actually, Zen of Stars and Foreseen. And then he did a compilation of the two books together, which is called Light Seeds. And I feature the first two books are on my website, directlightproductions.com, with the link to go to the page where you can purchase that book directly from Michael St. Clair. And I, as you well know, when I have authors on, I like to make it possible for you to read a little bit about their book and or books, and give you the opportunity to contact them or contact the distributor of their book. And that's anyone that's been on my website knows that they can click on books, and it takes you right there, and there's a whole list. And that will get updated as information comes out. But January 6th, at the regular time, for a period of 2 hours, Michael will be on Evident Footprints. And we're looking at that as a momentous event for several reasons. Number one, we're transitioning into a new period, astrologically speaking. I know many in the listening audience follow astrology. Michael is very scientific in his manner of assigning or discerning, let's say, astrological positions and the impact that they have. And he's made many predictions which have come true as a result. So it's not hocus pocus. It's really a science, and he knows it quite well and has been involved in it for the majority of his life. He consults with many corporations. He consults with the powers that be, because he can bring a lot of information to the table that's not seen through ordinary means. And there's a lot of intuition involved in the methods that he uses. He also has been manufacturing what he calls nuclear resonators. These are actually, and in fact I have one, it's very similar to a device that was known in Atlantean times. It is a some people would call it a wand. It's a collection of crystals or runes or certain gemstones that have the capacity to store energy and to transmute energy to allow one with a quiet and peaceful mind to discern things beyond the physical realm and even beyond the mental realm. This is not something that is a mental process per se, other than you quiet your mind and you allow images which come in the form of energy and let's say universal mind transmuted into the crystals, and by looking at the crystal or by holding the crystal in your hand, you make a connection with those energies, and then you begin seeing things. And it's for those out there that are superstitious, there's nothing dark about this or related to black magic. It's a device like we have in many scientific inventions. Crystals were used by a number of prolific inventors, including Nikola Tesla and Victor Schauberger, who we have talked about on this show quite a bit with the guest that was supposed to be on tonight, Jim Murray. Jim has studied their work. I have studied their work. Of course, Jim is actually a scientist and an inventor, so he puts these principles that he's learned from studying the works of Tesla and Schauberger and Reich and many other prolific scientists into inventions, into practical solutions, improving upon already existing technologies. And his forte is in the area of power. And it's well known since the late 1800s that Nikola Tesla was already using crystals in his research. So what Michael has done is created a whole variety of different resonators that are available for purchase, and he has designed resonators that are all different, because the crystals themselves are different and they have different capacities to transmute energy in a particular way. Many people will look at one or look at his whole collection and decide that they like the way one looks, or if you're fortunate enough to be close to him where you can actually hold these, you can make a connection with one. There is a resonance, there's a frequency that is compatible with your own, and you sort of either through the touch and the sensation that you get, or just the appearance, how it strikes you, They're very beautiful. They're very original and unique. And basically, to describe how he makes the wands, which are in sizes from 6 inches to 20 inches on average, some as wide as 3 or 4 inches across, depending on the size of the terminating crystal, the one that's on the end. He puts these in a mold using an epoxy resin, we could call it, and it's opaque. So you can see the crystals inside, and he sort of intuits how each one should be made as he's making it. It's not a cookie cutter formula that they all look alike. They're all quite different, and they range in prices, I think, from about 1,100 euros into the thousands of euros, depending on what he puts in there. He's put gold in some, various types of amethyst, and I think tourmaline. The very sensitive types of crystal that are good at transmuting light and this more subtle energies. So when Michael's with us here on Evident Footprints on January 6th, I'm sure he's going to talk about that. And you can visit his website at passage11.com. That's passage and the number 11 or 11.com. And we're looking forward to having him here. Now, it's not confirmed that he's going to be with George and Nori the night before, but basically he's told me that he's going to give a heads up to George and Nori that really this show that's going to be on BBS is going to be quite unique. Not just because of the number of people around the world that are going to be listening, but Michael and I have prepared a series of questions so that we can stay on track, because there's a lot of information that we're going to cover. And I asked some questions that I felt were representative of my listening audience and the types of things that I'm hearing you as the listeners ask me to talk about a bit. And clarify, because we're going to gradually move into areas of solution. We've been doing that on the show. Those of you who have been listening now for over 2 months, and specifically over the past 2 months, we have been addressing that issue of responsibility and individuality, sovereignty, freedom, creativity, communication, all of these things together. And for the purpose of pointing out who we are, so you can approach this yourself. This is not something that we are asking you as myself, the host, and a particular guest that I have on the show on any given night as to something that you should believe or that we're trying to convince you should believe. We're offering the information, and if you apply it, if you do some research, if you take action, you'll see that it really works. In my own life, I'm seeing indications that these principles work, and of course the communication can break down, and it often does, because we're not all on the same page. The idea is that if we understand these principles and put them to work and become habituated with them, we become comfortable, the fear leaves us, and we stop going back into the matrix, into the false reality that's been created for us. And since Jim's not here, and we were sort of going to touch upon this anyway, on the basis of what he and I have been discussing over the past couple of months, I'm going to talk a little bit about the ego and its relationship to the false reality. Now, we use words like ego in our everyday communications with people. We know people that that accomplish some feat in life, and depending on who that person is, they are taken by the general public to be egotistical if they brag about their accomplishments. One person that comes to mind who was really a character and maybe a bit of an actor in that sense was Muhammad Ali. Now, he was born in Louisville, Kentucky. His name originally was Cassius Clay, for those of you who are unfamiliar with boxing, and he became the heavyweight champion of the world by knocking out Sonny Liston. He was an Olympic champion. He was known as a very fast boxer, and his Olympic medal was as a light heavyweight, and he moved into the heavyweight ranks professionally, and first fight beat Sonny Liston to take the title, and then he became a legend. Now, he was known as being very brash. He would say things like, "I'm the greatest, there's nobody that can beat me," and today we call that trash talking in football or basketball or baseball. People are even penalized in the course of a game for talking like that. Yet, when we first heard Muhammad Ali talk like that, it was humorous. We laughed at it. We said, well, it's a bit of a stretch. And he actually made a career out of that with the announcer Howard Cosell, who was originally an attorney, turned sportscaster. And Cosell, and Ali would barb, with shadow box with words. And, Muhammad Ali was quite witty, quite sharp on his feet. He was a thinker. So, one could assume, and his life really, outside was something very admirable. He raised a family. He wasn't in all kinds of controversy. The only controversy he really had in his whole career was the fact that he refused to go to war and kill people. He was a conscientious objector to the draft, and for religious reasons, he refused to go to war, and he was stripped of his title for that, which was really unfair because he was just approaching his prime. He was still not in his prime. And that was an example to all of us that here's a champion, the heavyweight champion of the world, and we can bring this man down. We can send him to prison. We can strip him of his accomplishments. And this is what's done to humanity. Now, what happens to the rest of society when something like that happens to a person who, in a sense, is a sports hero? I hate the word icon. The media uses that word, but he was a household name. He was very well known for his accomplishments. He donated money to charities. He was very secret about that as well. And he did, accept the Muslim religion. He's not to be faulted for that. It certainly didn't corrupt him in any way. He was always, the athlete that he professed to be, was in some really incredible fights for any of you that know the sport of boxing, with Joe Frazier and, I'm trying to think of his name now, Norton, I remember the guy's last name and now I don't remember his first name. It'll come to me. He fought people who were, possibly the, Great White Hope. I remember Jerry Cooney was a guy that was bigger than Ali and fearsome looking, and Ali just tore him apart. Some of the toughest fights he had were with a guy that was quite a bit shorter than him, Joe Frazier. And Joe Frazier and Ali, and then of course there was George Foreman and many of the characters in the heyday of heavyweight boxing. Ali really, because of his stature, because of his accomplishments, and maybe because of his ego, or at least the persona he projected to everyone else, made him very famous, very well loved, and he loved people back, and very wealthy, very successful. Some years ago, I was in the Philippines and learned that outside of Manila, in one of the suburbs, there's actually the Ali Mall. Muhammad Ali owned a mall in the Philippines. And it was quite a large mall, quite a nice mall. So when he had a fight there in the Philippines, he took his money, and I presume he built the mall. he invested it wisely. So he was in his heyday, he was a very well-loved man, and he's still loved today. He suffers today from Parkinson's disease. Some say it's a result of how many times he received blows to the head. But there are many others who have Parkinson's who never boxed. So we shouldn't be too quick to assume that boxing is the cause of Parkinson's disease. It may influence the severity of it. I think you could have all kinds of problems by being hit in the head if you could survive the power of a heavyweight fighter. The point I'm making here is that, in general, he was known to have an ego. He was a person we would call egotistical, yet the way he really was belied that persona that he projected to promote the fights that raised millions of dollars. Now, there's the aspect of the ego. Do we have Jim on the line now?
Hey, Don, sorry about that. I had my phone on silent, and I didn't even realize it.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm glad we got a hold of you. Or did you call us?
Well, I called you, but then they called me back, and it went back and forth a couple of times, but I finally got you.
Well, you were playing phone tag then. Well, Merry Christmas. I was just on a monologue about ego, and just told the story of Muhammad Ali and sort of painting the picture of ego. I know that you and I had talked about the possibility of covering that aspect in terms of reality. We hadn't really settled on anything. Belated Merry Christmas to you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Merry Christmas to you, too, and to all the listeners. I hope it was a wonderful and fruitful holiday.
There was a lot of fruit and a lot of vegetables, I have to say that. Yeah, it was nice. It was quiet. It was peaceful and a lot of love. So, yeah, it was a very nice Christmas.
Well, good. Happy to hear that. As you know, I'm in New Jersey at the moment, so a little bit different from the situation in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
But came here for the holidays, and I'm glad we linked up.
Well, good. I'm glad you did, too. I'm not aware if you had prepared anything because of your traveling. We didn't have the chance to talk as we usually do to sort of map out a show. If you want, we can stay focused on this issue that I'm describing right now. I've invited the listeners to call. Seems like you're the only one listening. So.
Well, I have no problem with you sticking on the subject you started with. You're right, though. I didn't have a chance to prepare anything, but that's okay. We'll wing it. I'm usually fairly good at that.
Oh, yeah, you're excellent at that. Well, what I had done up to this point, Jim, is just recap what we've been doing over the past 2 months and stress that Michael St. Clair was going to be on the show on January 6th, and we were going to bring forth a whole new method of problem solving and solutions. We're going to talk about this in the unspoken, or from the unspoken realm. In other words, the using the language and the terminology and the topics that everyone refuses to tackle. I would have to say, probably with exception, you and I cover those often. We're going to look at the unknown. We're going to look at things from the perspective of the unknown, and leave all this other stuff behind. But as preparation, I thought, you know, in light of the fact that you weren't with us at the top of the hour, I would introduce or expound a bit on ego in the context of all the other things that we talked about. So, I'll get you in the conversation in a moment here.
Yeah, now, go right ahead, Don. You handle it as you see fit.
Now, we, in past shows, we talked about the individual. And we defined that word individual as a person who is a spirit being living in a body, having an experience in this reality we call life on planet Earth. And as an individual, you are indivisible. The real meaning of the word individual means indivisible, or unable to be divided. And yet everything about our reality is dividing you or separating you intentionally by how things are created. All the systems are created to keep you from being in touch with your true self, from exercising your sovereignty, exercising your inner knowledge, which is because of the system made to be oppressive in a sense, made to be subconscious or unconscious, or if it is conscious, it manifests itself in fear, and it manifests itself into this controlling system where you forfeit your sovereignty, your rights, your individuality, for the benefit of the whole. Yet the whole is suffering as much as the individual. If you look at this as it is, you can see that society right now is in turmoil. And the powers that be that have been controlling this game have created a monster which is actually going to implode upon themselves. They are the ones who are really programmed, even though they've been spending all their time programming us. They have an agenda, they have a program, and they are programmed to follow that. And all we have to do is jump off the merry-go-round, which is a phrase I use quite often, and see that. Now, what is the main method or the main mechanism behind their control over the masses? Well, it's ego identification. And ego is really not your true self. Much like I described Muhammad Ali, that his whole persona that he projected to people may have just been an act to psych out his opponents or to create interest. Like, well, what can a boxer do to endear people to him except to be brash and outspoken, to put on an air of bravado, invincibility, and it could very well have been true that he was invincible, at least for most of his career, most of the fights he fought, he won. Ken Norton is the gentleman I was trying to remember. Ken was a former martial artist and actually broke Ali's jaw, and Ali fought a whole fight with a broken jaw. Many would have quit right there. So that was quite remarkable, the heart that he had. So when you compare Ali's act with his heart, I would say most likely the ego that he portrayed was one of a character that he sort of latched onto and presented to us as if that was the real person. Those who knew or know him to be very witty, to be very loving, very kind, very generous, very honorable, a good father, an ambassador to the whole world. He brought people together from all around the world, and he's still doing that today. So ego now, in the other sense, is to look in the mirror and see yourself, to see a reflection of yourself, and someone says, oh, you look really nice today, or you look horrible today, or let's go get our hair done, let's put makeup, let's go buy some makeup, let's go get a new dress. We do all these things to alter our appearance, and we attach ourselves to that because we are drilled with that mind control, that mindset that we have to measure up to someone else's standard. And then we resent people judging how we look or how we might feel or what we say on the basis of how their ego feels offended. And this is all smoke and mirrors, folks. This is all illusion. There's really not a reality in it. You can say, well, it hurts me when somebody talks badly about me. When they insult me, it really hurts me. But you're not even realizing you're not being hurt, and it's not them, or it's not they that are doing it to you. We're doing it to ourselves, and we're seeing our reflection of our oneness in each other at the same time. As soon as you begin to see that now, you can escape the matrix. Jim, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, sure, Don. I agree with you 100% about that's not being our real selves. The fact of the matter is, if you go a step further, using the same example, for instance, of Muhammad Ali, even the more pleasing aspects of his personality, as you described them, is also not really himself, because it's part of the ego mask that he presents to the world. It's just the more pleasant part of it. But in reality, the ego, as it is perceived by everybody, is a kind of a fake person that that we construct because of forces and feelings and beliefs that we harbor within us, and which are formed, you know, since our infancy. And basically, it's a mechanism that allows us to present to the world a portrait, sort of the way we believe we really are. But most of it is constructed to protect ourselves from who we really are. This is the reason why, even with the situation of someone who is seeking psychiatric assistance, for instance, they are always, the first task is always to penetrate the characteristics of the ego and find the real person, the real forces behind that mask, so that the analyst knows, you know, the right aspects to deal with. Now, what's interesting about it is this, even though the person voluntarily may go to seek help from the analyst, in reality, he always resists any attempt on the psychiatrist's part to penetrate this facade and get to the real him or the real her. And there again, it's part of the mechanism that allows the patient to perceive himself in a certain way. And they don't want that structure penetrated or collapsed, because then it's going to change their perception of themselves as well. And so there's this whole big resistance situation that the person puts up, and it's to persist in the illusion that he has of himself, really. And the reason for that is because he's afraid, he's actually afraid of the resulting changes that are going to occur if he's forced to look at the real him. And this is kind of difficult to understand, but it's really true, because there's actually less anxiety or less fear or less horror or whatever term you want to use in living the lie of who we think we are than there is in facing the true situation of what we really are. And if you think that it's difficult in terms of resistance to being cured or changed from the psychological point of view, just imagine the resistance that exists on the higher scale of the spiritual realm, where there's a similar situation that we also resist because we're more inclined to want to remain where we are in the scheme of things.
I agree with what you're saying. That's the essence of psychiatry. If it's being approached with 100% integrity, where I take issue is when they say, well, you have this problem, therefore you need this drug. You have to start taking this drug. I'm going to prescribe this to you. And it starts a whole myriad of other problems.
That of course is nonsense. I mean, the real masters of the science, like Wilhelm Reich, whom I idolize very much, they never used any drugs. They realized that if you start to induce, it's like trying to solve a mathematical equation that has a whole bunch of variables, and while you're solving it, you're generating additional variables. Mm-hmm. It's never going to happen. And to complicate the issue by introducing drugs into the so-called patient is a no-winner, because you're going to wind up creating psychosis based on the reaction of the drugs, which is going to further complicate the issue. But look at it the other way. One of the reasons this happens is because the people that are treating these patients are just as nuts as the people they're trying to help. Mm-hmm. And they're not generally plugged into the right belief system in the first place. Mm-hmm. So they honestly have become victims of the system and believe in the power of the drugs, because that's what they're taught.
Yes.
So they're just as messed up as the people they're trying to help.
Well, I was once hiring or interviewing a guy. I did hire him. I was interviewing him for a sales position in our piano store. And I had asked him some questions about his work experience and his attitude about selling and demonstrating the product in terms of his comfort level with his musicianship and talking to people. I was trying to determine that this is going to be somebody representative of the type of people that I wanted to be working with. So I asked him some questions, and then he asked me what sort of people were our clients. And I said, well, they come from all walks of life. There are people who are doctors and lawyers and scientists and teachers and factory workers and gardeners and on. Some are ministers. They all have an interest in music. Some will sign up for lessons and they're making an investment when they purchase an instrument in not just in a piece of furniture or a musical instrument, but in themselves. You have to feel comfortable talking to all these different people. And he asked me specifically, he said, do I have to sell pianos to nurses? And I said, well, why would you single out nurses? Do you have something against nurses? And he proceeded to tell me that he was an orderly in a mental institution. This was in California. And he said the nurses really abuse the patients. The doctors usually aren't around to see this, and I don't have a lot of respect for the nurses. And I said, well, we have some nurses that actually take lessons here. They're customers. They're very nice people. And he said, he summed up what you just said. As far as I see it, the only difference between the nurses and the patients is the nurses have keys to get out of the place. Which was a very eye-opening statement from this individual. And he was the spitting image of Phil Collins, the former drummer of Genesis and the solo artist of renown in pop music. So Tom was this guy's name. Tom was really a character, but it really made me think about what he had said. Now, I had to help him overcome this bias or this prejudice that he had on the basis of his personal experience. It may have very well been true in his experience, yet it's not the experience of anyone that's been or everyone that's been around a nurse. I know a lot of nurses that have saved people's lives, so it's a very admirable profession when approached with integrity. Now, in terms of what you're talking about here, we're dealing with solving one's reaction to an illusion. If we look at all these things, these problems that a person is having, dealing with issues that are many times just personality differences or something that someone did to another person, the reason for doing these things a lot of times had to do with money. Or it had to do with a job or something that was promised to them, a broken relationship where one person felt that they had been sabotaged in some way. And these issues always rise out of the ego. They're born out of the ego, the false self. And I think, you know, it's quite a job for a psychiatrist or a psychologist to deal with someone who's suffering from, we say delusional. In other words, they're suffering from the effects of these illusions, and yet do they always approach it from the highest truth? Do they always dispel the illusions, or do they ever dispel the illusions? Well, some they may. The fears that these people have are also born out of worry and misinterpretation of what's actually going on. So our own recognition or our own knowledge of who we are really has everything to do with why some of us have these types of problems, whether they're mental problems or whether they cause one to become criminal in nature, acting out some unresolved situation, whether it's in this lifetime or it has a karmic association to it, or genetic association, or it may be a result of drugs that were prescribed at some point in the person's life. Lots of reasons for it, but these are all on the other side. They're not who we are. That's the essence of what I'm trying to underscore here. Is that we are not the ego, and we are not all these situations that arise as a result of our identification with the ego. And once we can grasp that concept, then we can really begin to look at who we really are and understand that we're all connected to each other. That the whole thing was designed to divide us and to separate us, even from ourselves, even from our true nature. Your turn.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely true, but I think it's actually more complicated to get the idea across because of that very reason. In other words, by the time you're old enough to think about these issues, you're already so far separated from who or whatever you were meant to be that you honestly believe that the you perceive is you. And that's part of the whole problem.
Belief.
is because the individual is also disconnected from his nature. And in my opinion, and of course it's only my opinion, I really believe that the so-called fall of man really revolves around this basic issue. Because no matter how you struggle to understand the true nature of human beings on this world, the real nature of people in this environment or in this plane of consciousness is so far removed from what we perceive that it may be impossible to really know the true nature of what we were meant to be. And this is, interestingly enough, part of the reason why this happens is because of our intelligence. Animals don't have that problem, although they do to a lesser degree when they're domesticated. But for the most part, they're somehow managed to stay plugged in to the overall gestalt, or the overall consciousness that they are a part of. And I think that the hints seem to indicate, Don, that the real nature of the thing was supposed to be that you could easily jump from one consciousness to the other. In other words, it's okay to have a personal identity of sorts, which is actually associated with the body that you live in and the immediate circumstances surrounding your birth and your upbringing. But when that wasn't necessary, you could also plug into the superconsciousness and be one of the herd, so to speak. And this is very evident in the life of birds. If you can fondle and become friends with a Canadian goose, you know that he has a certain little personality. He's an interesting guy. He's got preferences and even personal interests, you might say. But as soon as you release him to run with the rest of the flock, they will turn together in unison. They will do all these things that to the outside person appears to be miraculous, because it's like, well, how do they all know when they're going to turn? How do they all know when they're going to fly away? How do they all know these things? It's because under those conditions, they're plugged into a super consciousness, which takes care of that whole flock. And humanity has a super consciousness that it's plugged into. The problem is 99.9% of the people aren't aware of it anymore. And the ones who are plugged into it, we refer to as mystics and psychics, mediums, spiritualists, you know, you name it. And that's only because they appear to be so different. Well, imagine if everyone could get past the barriers of their ego and the other negative aspects of existence that are imposed by our life on this plane, you would have an amazingly different world. Because you could be plugged into the super consciousness or the racial consciousness or the planetary consciousness, depending on how big you want to expand the phylum, and at the same time you'd also be capable of an individual existence, and the world would be a very, very different place. Now, one thing that might help people to understand just how much armoring, and I'm going to use that word because it's so descriptive, and Reich used it to explain the contradiction between the healthy human being and the human being that's a product of all this programming. To understand how much armoring we really have and how it has changed us, it's really necessary to use an example. And bear in mind that while the example is a very valid one, it's one 10,000th, perhaps, of the overall amount of conditioning and changing that we are forced to undergo by the world around us. and which eventually contributes to the construction of the so-called ego, which we carry as our mask throughout most of our lives. And in order to paint that picture, Don, let me just use a real simple example. We've got the average man who has been taught by his father, perhaps, that it's not manly thing to, for a boy to cry. And so he starts to impose this ideology upon his son at a very early age. And when he sees his son crying about something, it actually upsets him to the point where he gets angry at the boy and chastises him for displaying this unmanly emotion. And this is actually where the expression swallow your tears comes from, because as you know, when you're when you are crying and sobbing, there are muscles, and whole groups of muscles in the throat, in the chest, in the face, around the eyes, and everywhere, which participate in the act of crying. And when you're involved in crying and someone is yelling at you for doing so, you also want to please your parent, and you want to avoid further chastisement. And so when he says, stop that stupid crying, you make an effort, and what happens is that you set up an opposing set of muscular stimuli to counteract each of the ones that are associated with the act of crying. So, for instance, the heaving of the chest, you force that to stop. The movements in the throat that are associated with crying, you set up a counter activity to that. You straighten your face, which is instead of being in a frown, you try to bring it back to its normal condition. And you do the same with the eyes, and on and on and on. And if you do this enough times, what happens is that you set up this counter set of forces every time you feel the urge to cry in the first place. And so after many years of doing this, you no longer can cry. And this is the beginning of the formation of the a very rigid personality, which doesn't respond to the emotional side of things. And it's the basis of many different types of psychosis and many different types of mental disorders. They all have their basis in this type of training.
Phobias, especially, yeah.
And it pertains to all manners of expression, not just crying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just use that as an example. But you can literally wind up with a person that's absolutely dead. They can't respond to any of the things that they were supposed to be plugged into, because people they always talk in metaphors, simply because the language structure doesn't give them another alternative. The problem is they come to believe the metaphors, and that's where the errors are. Like, for instance, they'll say, the things I feel in my heart, the things that I wish I could do, and all these different things. The real fact of the matter is you don't feel anything with your heart. All emotions make their avenue of expression through the musculature, and this is a really well-known fact. All emotions reside in the muscles, and the muscles have a very strange property that they can have, they can be totally free of any inhibitions, and therefore your emotional structure is most pronounced, or they can be impeded because there are contradicting forces involved. And when this happens, not only do you have a very pronounced problem on the emotional scale, but if it's intense enough, you actually have a hardening of the muscles. And this is just another way of saying that all disorders which start on the spiritual and mental plane wind up having an effect on the physical plane as well. And it was basic information of this sort that brought Wilhelm Reich to the understanding of the muscular armoring phenomenon in the first place. And once he understood it, he started looking for ways to alleviate it. And that gets us back to the very question that you wanted to delve into tonight, because there's resistance to that alleviation. And let's look at the example I used concerning the crying to understand that a little bit better. Let's assume that you had a really, really aggressive and overbearing parent who essentially is responsible for you not being able to cry. And naturally, if you can't cry, that's a whole segment of your life that's shut off, because we're supposed to respond a certain way to negative stimuli. And now this person can't do it. So they go to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist, if he's good, or the analyst, which is really a better term, if he's really good, he'll understand the problem long before the patient does. And the real challenge that he has is to constructively direct the patient's understanding of himself until you reach a point where the person understands that he's doing this to himself in response to something that was done to him at a very early age. And that, whatever that was, that conditioning that was brought to bear by the stern parent, may represent such a negative and unpleasant apparition or experience to that person that on his subconscious level, he's fully aware of where he needs to go to understand his problem. He doesn't want to relive it. He doesn't want to face that chastisement, that negativity, that overbearing sensation, or, and in some cases, punishments that he would have to remember in order to bridge that gap and understand why he's not crying.
Mm-hmm.
And so he actually puts up resistance on one level to prevent the psychiatrist from taking him there.
Yeah.
And that's why these cures can span so many years.
Mm-hmm.
When they do happen.
Yes.
And don't forget, there are hundreds of these emotional impedances that we're forced to bear because of the structure of our society and all of the problems that go with it. And most of them are going to be in the most intense regions of our emotional structure. So
yes.
any emotion which is the most has the greatest potential for fulfillment is usually where you have these problems. And that's why sexual problems are at the top of the chart. So I hope that answers your question just a little bit.
Yeah. What comes to mind while you're saying this, and I want to relate something that I saw this evening. I don't watch very much television at all. And in the process of waiting for the commercials to transpire on the news channel or the news channels, I did a little bit of surfing and I landed on this show, which I want to talk about in a moment. I wanted to stress that there are people listening to this that understand perfectly clearly what you're talking about. And based on what I saw on the TV show, I can tell you there are people that are eons away from ever grasping the fundamentals of what you just described. There's a show called Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? It's hosted by the comedian Jeff Foxworthy that does sort of a country redneck type of humor. And, you know, he makes fun of himself and rednecks, which is the term for people that are from the country, from the South, cowboys, farmers, people that are living in their own little world, let's say, but decent people. Now, this show is such that they bring an adult on the show, and they have to answer a series of questions, and they begin. At least this show, I haven't seen it really beyond what I saw tonight, and I watched 15 minutes of it, and I could see the dumbing down of the masses taking place on the set, in the studio audience, and definitely anybody that was watching this and was intrigued by or interested in what was going on from an entertainment level. Now, keep in mind there's an implied statement being made that they're going to make an adult look stupid, and we're supposed to be entertained by this. It's really a sorry appraisal of society and our educational system. They brought a guy out whose major in college is cellular biology and biological chemistry. A dual major he has, and he's normally the show has five fifth graders sitting at desks off to the side, and there's a podium where the contestant is playing, and they can win up to $1 million. They answer a question for $1,000 and maybe $5,000, $10,000. It keeps increasing until it gets up to $1 million. The first question posed, and this guy had five of his fraternity brothers there with him. So he has 10 people that he can call upon to save him in case he's not sure of the answer. They start with the first grade question. You're standing on the equator. What direction do you look to see the sunrise? The guy said, well, I know the sun either comes up from the east or the west. That was the first statement he made. This is a guy majoring in cellular biology making this statement. But he couldn't answer the question, so he called on one of his fraternity brothers, and he said it comes from the north. Now, the kids eventually saved this guy because the guy would have been disqualified, but they let him use a lifeline and ask one of the kids, and the kid said, the east, of course. Doesn't really matter where you're standing on the planet, the sun always rises from the east. Or generally speaking, okay? But from the equator, definitely from the east. That was the question. The second question was, camels have two humps on their back. True or false? The humps are used to store water. The guy answered true, and of course, he called upon one of his college buddies, and he said true as well, and the kids knew the answer. It was false. They knew that the humps store fat. Now, if that were the case, you would see every time a camel ran out of water, it would lose its humps. It only takes a moment to think that through if you're not sure about the answer. But that escapes everyone. The third question was a little bit more difficult. Now, they got up to the third grade level on this question, and it was the song America. And they gave the first line, "My country, 'tis of thee." Tell us what the words are in the second line, which would be "Sweet Land of Liberty." But you heard anything but that, and it had nothing to do with the song. People were making up words that didn't even fit the meter. They didn't rhyme, and they had nothing to do with the song. That took 15 minutes for them to present that, and every time the college student gave his response, the audience applauded as if they were congratulating him on a correct answer. It was just insanity to watch this, to see the stupidity. And then I began thinking about the person that thought this up to present this to the American public as entertainment, as a quest in the search of knowledge or to show one's mental prowess. It was insulting, and it was so obvious what was being done. It's really a sad state. Now, that's what being in the Matrix is all about. That's being 100% in the Matrix, to where you can't even think. You can't even solve a problem, a simple problem that every day of your life, if you're not sleeping all the time, you kind of notice what direction the sun comes up if you are aware of your orientation, the way your house or apartment sits on a street or where you're walking. You kind of notice where the sun comes up and where it goes down. Yet this guy could not answer the question. Neither could his college buddy.
Well, that's not a surprise, though, to be honest with you. I see this in science and engineering all the time. People are not thinking. As a matter of fact, and I've said this on the show before, as you well know, there would be no problem solving the so-called energy shortage issue if it weren't for the fact that people are programmed, literally programmed, through the mechanisms of rebukement, punishment, banishment, bad reputation, and only God knows what other mechanisms, to completely accept the traditional viewpoints concerning conservation of energy. And I've seen the mechanism work so effectively that it doesn't even matter if you're showing them something that that's anomalous in its behavior, where you think the true scientific mind would be so excited it would dive right into that and say, "Wow, this is really wonderful. Let's check that out in detail." No, sir, that's not what the programming says. The programming says energy can either be created nor destroyed. And anything that even remotely smacks of a different point of view shuts down the entire brain.
Yeah. Hey, and, Jim, you're distorting. Your voice is distorting quite a bit. Putting a lot
is that
of.
Any better?
Yeah, that's a little better. Yeah.
Yeah. What happened was I had the thing on. I had the telephone on. What do they call that? Speaker. And. I tried to put it back after the need for it had gone, and I pushed the wrong button. So now I'm afraid to mess with it because what will probably happen will be I'll get disconnected. So I apologize for that.
Yeah, it's really distorting. I'm getting a message from Don in the studio that it sounds like you're yelling to me anyway. You might be. I could have boosted your energy level a little bit there.
Well, I can try to get out of this thing at the risk of disconnecting us, and if that does happen, you can just phone me back. I don't know what else to say.
Okay, we'll try that. Well, I use that for an example because here we are, we're speaking about these deeper truths about who we are and what we are. We haven't really dealt with that issue, but we know that we're not these illusions, and we're given something far, far less than even what the Matrix is about. I mean, they've lowered this level. You know, we're trained to think that things are linear. Everything moves from point A to point B, and I could see nothing but this guy standing in an elevator shaft or in an elevator that had no bottom, and he was just going down, 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 lower into a lower state of consciousness. And that was in 15 minutes. I couldn't bear to watch any more of it. And, of course, when I went to the news channel, it was just as bad. And they weren't doing a game like that, but certainly there was a mind game going on. And it was just more of the same nonsensical trash being peddled as news, as something that we should know. It's definitely a sign that, I should follow my own advice to my listening audience. Unplug the set and actually take it out to the garbage and just refuse to look at it, because it serves no purpose other than to gauge where they are in this whole thing. I think we can see that reflection in our fellow travelers. As, you know, as we experience life on a day-to-day basis, you can see how people are acting, how they're driving down the street, or the stupid things that they do, the way they react to changes in weather or a change in time, and definitely they're reacting to all of these staged events that are being doled out like dessert in a candy store.
Yeah, well, it's pretty bad. There's no question about that. And just imagine, by the time you get down to the level of the individual in society who happens to need psychiatric repair of some sort, you're really just at the top of the problem, you know, in terms of the overall complexity, because, as you've so aptly pointed out, the entire society needs psychiatric help. It's not just the one individual. The culture, if you want to use that word, and actually I find that word offensive because, you know, strictly speaking, modern United States has no culture, unless you look at the Matrix as its culture.
And, mm-hmm.
But anyway, the whole darn culture needs to be rectified. And even if we were to start today on that kind of a project, only God knows how many generations it would literally take to undo the damage that's been done. The human race has deliberately been held in spiritual and mental, and for that matter, physical bondage for centuries. And the interesting thing is, part of the armoring associated with society, or to put it in more succinct terms that represent the theme of tonight's show, part of the ego structure of society in general, in this country at least, is the mistaken belief that we're free. You know, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. You're taught that this is the land of the free. You're taught that since you're a very small child. And so you put up with all this other garbage because you know that's just part of being free. You know, the slavery is part of the freedom.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And you know that to be true.
Mm-hmm. Well, it definitely points out the fact that there's a lot that has to be overcome. Now, how things are going to play out and in the coming days and weeks and months are going to have a lot to do with how willing people are to really look at these issues seriously. There are some that say, I'll deal with that when it happens. I'll deal with it, I'll cross that bridge when I come to it. And there is no bridge there. It's an abyss. It's a canyon is what it is. And you either have to have a parachute or you better learn to fly, because the bridges around this nation are in disrepair, as are the roads. It's a question of ultimately it's a question of spiritual warfare that's going on. It's just been reduced to such a low vibration in the consciousness of the average person that they can't even contemplate that. What they take as spirituality is a moment that they might feel good after having a few too many drinks, or winning the lottery, or having some event that's just out of the norm of their everyday existence. And it, you know, you pointed it out well when you were describing animals. It's when they become domesticated that they end up having problems. They take on some of these issues themselves. But innately, they're designed to work with nature, and they gravitate toward that. They don't have to be taught these things. There are certain skills that a dog might learn, or a cat, or a bird, but they do quite well amongst themselves.
Well, I'm sure that humans, under the right circumstances, would do quite well amongst themselves also. But what people fail to realize, Don, is that the entire structure into which we are born is part of the illusion. It's part of the conditioning. I mean, just take, for example, the contrast between a baby born in a grass shack in New Guinea somewhere and raised in a loving environment by the entire tribe and taught really basic skills since he's a child. And those skills have nothing to do with reading, writing, and arithmetic. They have to do with understanding the environment, knowing which animals are beneficial, knowing which ones can hurt you, you know, being tuned in to Mother Nature in every direction possible, finding a mate at a very early age without criticism or punishment, and on and on and on. And contrast that to a child born into a maternity ward in some big hospital. First thing that happens is he gets his ass beat. Second thing that happens is they cut part of his penis off, and then from there in, it's all downhill. The buildings, the surroundings, nothing's natural. There's very few trees. There's no animals except the ones that are in cages like you are. And the entire thing is just a production line. It's designed to produce a certain outcome. And that outcome carries the really shabby tag called civilization. But in becoming so-called civilized, you are forced to divorce yourself from your higher nature.
Mm-hmm.
And the higher nature, in this case, is the natural part of you, the part that where all these sensitivities and normal inclinations are usually residing. And so once you cut yourself off from that, you become this other thing, which is only half alive.
Yes.
And we call that being free. We call that being civilized. We call that modern-day man. I'm not so sure that we've improved anything at all.
Yeah, in our closing moments here, Jim, what would you say, and I, you know, you're not the prophet here or necessarily the specialist, but certainly your perspective is well taken and honored on, because you're making a whole lot of sense, everything you're saying. For the people out there that are considering how they might discern who they are. You know, when you ask the question, if I'm not this ego, if I'm not the person that I see in the mirror, then it naturally leads to another question. Then who am I? Or what am I? And that is, as you will probably agree, that's the first question one asks themselves on the path to enlightenment or on the path to consciousness. Or connecting with a higher frequency. If they're not satisfied with where their life is, it may very well be that they're becoming dissatisfied with what we've been talking about. All this programming, this predetermined outcome made for them, to them, at them, by someone else. What would you suggest one would do to liberate themselves from that, or to free themselves from it?
Well, you know, Don, there used to be an exercise that they gave kids to do years ago to help them determine the best career to pursue in the course of their lives. And it's very interesting because I don't see that happening anymore. But considering the question you just asked, it actually makes sense to use that same type of little mind game to explore who we are, or perhaps a better way of putting it is who we should have been. Because, you know, to get back on the original track this late in the game is not an easy thing to do. It's going to take a lot of effort. And it may or may not be feasible, but at least you have to make a play for it if you expect to make any progress in our own development. And the game is a very simple mind experiment, and it's very easy to do. You picture yourself sitting on a stage in front of thousands and thousands of people, and you know that you're about to be introduced. And somebody gets up on the podium and starts talking about you, and they are essentially laying the groundwork for your introduction. And you are then expected to make some comments, make a speech perhaps, or whatever. And the idea here is to use your imagination and free association of thought and feeling and just say to yourself, well, what am I being introduced for? You know, the world's greatest chemist, a journalist of great renown, you know, a scientist, an explorer, whatever. And the stuff that flows from you freely regarding that introduction, it has a lot to do with where you subconsciously were designed to go. The problem is most people suppress that, or they don't want to look at it because they're afraid of the fact that they have whitewashed their original intention or their original feelings, you know, to put on a different suit of clothes than what they were intended to wear. And so there again, we run into this resistance. But if you can do that little experiment with a certain amount of freedom and a certain amount of integrity, you'll be surprised at what comes back. You know, I mean, I actually still do that. And from time to time, of course, you can't do it every day. But I still do that little experiment. And there's two or three things that keep bouncing back every time I do that. At least they're consistent. And they're not what I'm doing right now at all. But upon further reflection, I still have enormous emotional energy in those directions. And that's the whole point, is to discover not what you're doing for a living, but what is your heart telling you would like to be doing. Don't pawn it off as a daydream. There's great importance in finding out what that is. Because once you realize and come to grips with the truth of what you really intended or what you really wanted, there's a doorway there that if you have the courage to go through it, it can lead you down the path of enlightenment. The one story that comes to mind about this very thing is portrayed by Dennis Hopper in the movie Giant, the head of the household is this great oil man, a cattle man, and he expects his son to do the same thing, and there's a lot of resistance from the kid because he actually wants to be a doctor. And luckily in his case, he breaks through and follows his heart's desire. But a lot of us would succumb to pressure from the parent, pressure from the family, pressure from society, and become something we may not want to be. And that sets up a whole series of forces in our lives that we spend the rest of our days lamenting on some level. So it's a real important experiment, Don, but it's very simple to do.
Yeah, I would have to agree with you. Now, when I was 5 years old, I can consciously recall choosing music as my profession, and I followed that. I didn't foresee at the time my journalistic career or even becoming a talk show host. If you would have told me that two years ago or 2.5 years ago, I would have laughed at you and told you you were crazy. And yet, I think being in tune with that aspect of myself in regard to music opened the door for these other possibilities. I haven't given up music, or because I'm a talk show host doesn't make me give up journalism. I see that they're all just different facets of the same gem in a metaphorical way. In that,
you just hit on a real important thing, see? That the real you is not the journalist or the musician or the night show host. It's something that automatically encompasses all those talents and many, many more all at the same time. Now, our society is not set up to accommodate people who have so many different talents and so many different desires to fulfill in their lifetime. The general arrangement is you have to be a doctor, you have to be a lawyer, you have to be a fireman. You can't be a whole bunch of things all at one time. And so it begs for the explanation of, well, what is it that can be so many things at one time? And that's where we start to get into the true spiritual nature of each of us and the realization that it's impossible in a given lifetime to be all that we can be or to be what we really are, because we are the product of many, many interests, many pursuits, the energies and activities of many lives, and even though we carry that with us in its entirety throughout all the lifetimes that we have, our wholeness, the integrated whole that we are, affects every lifetime that we express. And the interests, the desires, the urges, the talents, and all these other things are all mixed together in this incredible, complex bucket of potential that we can draw from. And that's the real secret. You know, you have to realize that you're always more than you're allowed to be, but you have the potential to draw down whatever you need at any time. And that's actually the secret that all of these wonderful sages and gurus and yogis and what have you have been trying to teach for years. It's just that the sum of all that we are is greater than the part we perceive, but that doesn't mean that you can't have access to the whole thing.
Exactly.
But of course, you have to go through the pains of developing those channels that allow you to have that access.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Well said. In terms of being all you can be, I think the only place that can occur is in the army, as the commercial went.
Yeah, I mean, I'm heartbroken that I didn't go down that road.
Well, you opened the door to our next topic, I think. Maybe we should go a step further next week. That will be next year, too. January 2nd is when you're scheduled to come back. If you would care to, let's explore this a bit further and go into the spiritual dimension of this whole discussion.
Sure, Don, no problem. I'll be happy to contribute in that regard, and maybe we can sort of pick up where we left off, because there are hints right now that have emerged on how to achieve that, as you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I want to thank you for making it to the show, and I wish you a very happy new year, and I look forward to the shows that we're going to do this coming year. We've got some really exciting guests coming on board. You will be surprised to know that Dr. Richard Souder, the expert on tunnels and underground bases, is going to be a guest on the show, and we're going to talk about some of that history there. That'll be quite interesting. You and I have touched upon that on a number of shows, and
yes,
he's considered one of the world's experts in that area. So I'm looking forward to his appearance on the show. That'll be around the middle of the month. So happy New Year to you, Jim. And I want to wish the folks at BBS a happy new year. Don Newsom, Doug Newsom, for making Evident Footprints possible, and Don for doing the sound in Seth's absence. Seth is on vacation till next year, or maybe just next week. But anyway, thanks for doing the sound tonight, Don. And I'd like to thank the listening audience for tuning in all year long. The year's not over. We'll be back next Monday. We've got a few more shows till we run out of time in 2008. And those of you who, for whatever reason, are going out of town and won't be able to listen to the show, I wish you a happy new year ahead of time. In the meantime, thanks for tuning in, and have a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.